And Jason will be talking about crescent black hole images. Okay?
How is this on? Is this volume okay? Everything's good. Great. All right, well, good morning, and thanks for braving the snow to be here this morning. Thanks also to the organizers for inviting me to speak today and for accommodating my sort of constrained travel schedule. So yeah, I just moved about a month ago to MPE Garching, where I'll be starting a small group. And one of the main topics of this group is trying to understand images of black holes for Event Horizon Telescope data, as well as future data from the VLTI gravity experiment. And I'll talk about what we think we might see with the Event Horizon Telescope today. So I'll show some results from numerical simulations that were done by Christopher Gill and Jonathan McKinney. And I had the good fortune at Berkeley to work with undergrads, and especially Angela Ricarte is here now, a grad student at Yale, and has a poster outside, so you should check that out. Okay. So the first point is that, in my opinion anyway, interpreting EHT data will require modeling at all stages. So in the era that we're in now, with very few stations and limited coverage, we really have no choice. And that's shown in this plot of the original data here, where you can either fit these original data with a Gaussian model for what the surface brightness is, or with a model that's a ring, so an annulus with a hole in the middle of it. And your interpretation of what these data mean depends on what model you use. So in this Gaussian case, you find something very compact that then must be offset from the black hole. Whereas in this case, you'd have a ring of emission that's centered on the black hole. So what you get depends on what you put in. And even down the line later, once the data are much better, we'll still, I think, want to use models to do quantitative comparisons in the best way. So to combine all the different observables, polarization phases, and all these great things. So the question is then, what do we expect black hole images to look like? What do we expect to see looking at light from gas very close to an event horizon? Okay. So there are several important effects. I think the main one is that we expect that black holes might cast a shadow. And this detecting this shadow is a major first goal, I'd say, for the Event Horizon Telescope, one of the major science goals. The reason that we expect a black hole to cast a shadow is that there's this effective cross-section of a black hole. So if you shine, say, a flashlight on a black hole from behind, then inside of the region where light can go in circles around a black hole, you get all of that light is absorbed from behind. And even when the emission is not coming from behind the black hole, even when it's coming from around, so say in an accretion flow or the base of a jet or something, we still expect, if it's optically thin, to see a decrease in flux inside this region. Okay, and this was first calculated by Jim Bardeen, who's here today. But there are other important effects as well that shape what we expect to see. So the other main important effect is Doppler beaming. We expect that gas falling down towards black holes should have angular momentum. It should circularize at some point. As it gets very close, that orbital speed approaches the speed of light, and so the emission is strongly beamed in the direction of motion of the gas. And that causes asymmetry in these images. So the part where the gas is approaching the observer is much brighter in these images typically than where it's receding on the other side. Okay, and this on the left is for a spherical gas distribution, but we expect that you might have instead maybe something like an accretion disk or a torus of gas, so not spherically symmetric. And in that case, you get light bending effects, where light is bent from the back of the black hole above and below, and the combination of this light bending with this Doppler beaming gives you this characteristic crescent shape for a black hole image. Okay. And in this picture, these are different polarizations, so showing that the light is coming from different locations around the black hole. The other cool thing here is you can see this bright ring, and this is surrounding the black hole shadow. So this is directly corresponding to the circular photon orbit around a black hole. And if you could detect this ring, measure its shape, and do things like that, then you can test, say, the No-Hare theorem or something like that, as Tim talked about before. Okay. So a lot of what we theorists have done then is try to do updated versions of this picture. So I'll show a movie from our work of using numerical simulations of gas accreting onto a black hole and trying to look at what these time-dependent images or movies look like. Okay, so this is a simulation by John McKinney, and the way this will play is it'll start at edge-on viewing and then rotate to viewing face-on and then back to see how the image changes. Okay, so when we're edge-on, we get this strong Doppler beaming on this side causing asymmetry in the image. And this image has this very characteristic crescent shape. There's a black hole shadow in the middle. You might be able to make out this circular photon ring here. As we go to face-on viewing, this becomes much more like a ring. It becomes circularly symmetric. This is more like the ring shape that people were using to fit the data before. And then as we go back to more edge-on viewing, then again, we get this asymmetry, and we get this nice crescent shape. So in some sense, then, the geometric shape that you might expect is maybe linked to the viewing geometry, that if you're looking edge-on, then Doppler beaming is more important, and there's more asymmetry than when you're looking face-on. Okay. And so what we've done then is taken a bunch of these types of theoretical images calculated from ray tracing and compared them to the millimeter VLBI data and other spectral data. And for any given model that you choose, you can try to estimate parameters then of the viewing geometry and the accretion and of the accretion flow as well. But the main thing I want to point out is that the inclination from fitting to Sag J star data seems to be in this regime where it's sort of at moderate inclination, so not very edge-on and very Doppler beamed, and not face-on and very circularly symmetric. And what that means is that for a wide range of models that you choose, the image that you get out has this characteristic crescent shape to it. And this is true. These are scatterbroad and best fit images from different models for the underlying gas. So if you choose an accretion disk, it can look sort of like this. If you then tilt the disk, the physics in the accretion flow changes quite a bit. You get these standing shocks. But nonetheless, if you fit it to the data, you can often get these crescent type of shapes here. And even if you put material at the base of a jet close enough to a black hole, and then it can actually, the emission can come from the counterjet, and you can get a nice crescent image there as well. Okay, so I think this is a natural, at least first expectation for what the images then might look like. Okay, and this is not just true for us. Many other groups are doing these calculations, and many other groups at least find similar images for the Sag J star data. Okay, and this is nice because it's a characteristic shape that we can start with. But one of the problems with this is that there are a lot of systematic uncertainties in these individual models. So there's a lot of uncertainties. We don't know exactly what the initial conditions in the gas are, what the electrons are doing in these low luminosity accretion flows, and other things like that. And so what we can and will do is to have each theoretical group, you know, try to interpret data in terms of their model. But also it would be nice if we could have a easier way to sort of compare across models or to develop something that's sort of model independent to describe the data, but that is also motivated physically by theory. Okay. And so what we've done in that regard is develop a geometric model now that's not a Gaussian and not a ring, but instead tries to describe this crescent. Again, this thing is extremely simple. It's the difference between two constant intensity disks of emission shown here, and it has five parameters. So one more parameter than an asymmetric Gaussian model, two more than a ring. And the ring model is a subset of this where you put the inner thing that you subtract off in the middle, centered with the same origin as the outer ring. Okay. And now what we can do is we can go back and fit this model directly to the data. So what's nice is that this model can also, you can try to use this model to reproduce theoretical images. So you can, for any theoretical image that you have, you can find its equivalent crescent model. And then so you can hope then to, by fitting this model to the data instead, use it as kind of a bridge between theory and observation. Okay, so we can fit this model to the data, and this was done by Ayman bin Qamruddin, who's a Berkeley undergraduate. And you can show that fitting this geometric shape provides better description of current Sag J star data than either ring shapes or Gaussians, even accounting for its extra free parameters. And this is very similar to a result that Avery had before from using a theoretical model, a radiatively inefficient accretion flow model, except that here it's nice because it's a little more of a direct comparison, geometric shapes to geometric shapes. Okay. So the other thing we can do is we can try to test whether this crescent model seems to work so far. So in Sag J star, the main uncertainty that we had is the viewing geometry. And not knowing the viewing geometry means that there's a lot of uncertainty. The images are very sensitive to the viewing geometry. So if you don't know the viewing geometry, then you could say skeptically that maybe all that you're fitting is you're using an asymmetric image to basically adjust it so that you get the right thing for the current Sag J star data. But in M87, we have this nice opportunity where these observations of the larger scale jet maybe tell us the viewing geometry. So we know roughly the inclination to M87, and we know that the large scale jet points sort of in a direction. Maybe the black hole spin axis points in the direction of the large scale jet. Okay, and so what we did then is use similar models, theoretical models, but with these crescent shapes, and we tried to predict what the millimeter VLBI observations of M87 would find. Okay, so we made predictions that they should see something that with current stations, they could fit the data with a Gaussian model, and that they'd find a size full width half max of something like 33 to 44 microarcseconds. And this is in good agreement with what was then later measured of 40 microarcseconds. So certainly these crescent type models are not the only thing that can fit the data. Many models can fit the current M87 data, but you could at least view this as maybe a validation that the crescent models are sort of on the right track. And if so, if black hole images are really crescent shaped, then it has a couple of interesting, there are a couple of interesting applications of this already. Okay, so one thing is that this has very interesting implications for trying to find signatures of the black hole shadow, and that's basically shown here. So here's how one of these images wants to be oriented to try to fit the Sagittarius A star data, and here's its Fourier transform showing the visibility with the sampled points from current observations. And what this is saying is that basically it wants to be oriented so that our current data are sampling along this axis or sort of along this axis of the image. I mean, what that means is that we're really seeing just this bright spot here from Doppler beaming. But if we looked across this way, across this axis of the image, then we would see a bright spot, the black hole shadow in the middle, and then another bright spot. And that's shown here in this visibility. So what we can do is then interpolate to locations of future observations with future stations, especially on north-south baselines, and show that often you find signatures of the black hole shadow in these visibilities. Okay, and so I was particularly excited to hear about the detection of fringes between OPEX and the US because these models tend to predict a fairly large correlated flux density on these baselines. So I think, yeah, it'll be very interesting to compare in detail whether these types of crescent things can explain what we see there. Okay. So that was in the UV plane, but of course also if you can make images, that would be a fantastic way to see a black hole shadow. And that's particularly easy to do with these crescent shaped models. So here's an example of simulated images from one of these crescent models, in this case for M87, just showing that with seven stations, and I think this is maybe slightly out of date image processing simulation, but nonetheless, you can still very nicely see a black hole shadow in this simulated image here at the bottom. Okay. So if it is a crescent shape, I think that's pretty optimistic news for attempts to try to detect a black hole shadow with the EHD data. Another application is that we can now, if we can assume an underlying model, if we can assume that maybe black hole images are crescents, then we can use that model to simulate future data. When can the EHT reach its science goals as sort of a function of technical capabilities of the array? So as it goes from data that look more like this in quality and coverage to maybe more something like this someday. And this is work that Angelo Ricarte has done, and again, his poster is outside, and you should check it out. But what he did was basically to simulate future observations and try to answer questions about things like, so taking all of the current models that we have now that can explain the data, when can we tell them apart? And that's sort of now with higher sensitivity and or closure phases up through certainly by the time that we get ALMA joining the array. And you can also ask, if you take a crescent model and then add a photon ring on top of it with some amount of the total flux, when can you no longer miss that in the data? So what is your chance of missing it if it's there? And basically, that by the time that ALMA joins the array, you should no longer miss it for the predicted 5 or 10% of the flux that's in the theoretical models. Okay. So there are also many ways to get images that are not crescents. So it's not the only answer that you can get. So I want to highlight a couple. The first is that if you put the emission further away from the black hole, so in this jet model here of Avery's, then the light bending here is very weak, and you get something that's maybe more like a blob here. Another way that you can get a model that's not a crescent is if you have multiple bright components in the image. So this is one of those tilted disk models where there's standing shocks that have hot electrons that produce the emission you see. There's two of these standing shocks, so there's two bright spots if you look sort of face on. And a lot of these types of models can still fit the data. The point I want to make is if in this, or maybe in a case like what Monica showed with the disk and jet models, where you might also have two different or more components of bright emission, you should be able to tell this in the data just from seeing structural changes with the EHT data. So you wouldn't expect that both spots should stay the same brightness and vary coherently. So as the source varies in brightness, you should see different changes that lead to changes in the overall structure. Okay, so it should be readily apparent if multiple components that are in the case. And even with current data with several epochs, we can probably start to rule out some of these things. Another cool way to get non-crescent images is to add a tail of non-thermal electrons to your distribution function. So if you put them in the same location, thermal electrons have a much steeper emissivity and so have much more compact images, as shown here, than if you have power law electrons in a tail of the distribution function. And that means if you add up and put a tail onto your thermal distribution of electrons, you can get a hybrid image, as calculated by Alwin Mao, Berkeley undergraduate. It looks something more like this, where you have this compact emission here and then a halo around it. And the cool thing about these types of images, is that they're probably already can be constrained with Event Horizon Telescope data because we know that the source is compact, so we can probably constrain how much of the flux can be in a more extended component like this, which means that the Event Horizon Telescope is sensitive to the distribution function of electrons in a collisionless plasma, which is pretty cool. So there are ways to extend this in the future. So our simple geometric crescent model right now is this five-parameter thing. And I guess the main failing as using it for this bridge between theory and observation is just that it can't do a good job of reproducing very complicated theoretical images. So for instance, this image here from Josh Dolenz, it probably wouldn't do that great of a job of reproducing kind of the subtlety here, that basically this spot is much brighter, and then there's sort of this extended bit here. But you can do better. So Leo Benkovich at Haystack has worked on a 9-parameter version of this model, which remarkably is still analytic. So you can still do the Fourier transform analytically. It has sort of a varying surface brightness over space. So here's your kind of crescent here. The height is its brightness, and it varies over space. And then he also added in a Gaussian here to try to match images like this, where there's sort of this bright spot and then extended emission here. So anyway, there are ways to do this in more detail in the future, both to compare to better Event Horizon Telescope data and to more faithfully reproduce simulated images. Okay. So one question that we'd also like to address is that our current crescent-type models don't really say anything about polarization, which is an important observable. And so right now what we're doing is working on calculations of polarization from resolved polarization from accretion flows to try to understand, again, what should we expect to see. It's a little bit more complicated in some ways than total intensity because it's not really dominated by relativistic effects the same way that the crescents come from light bending and Doppler beaming. So here, the kind of characteristic thing, it depends on the magnetic field direction. So this is tracing out a toroidal field here. But it also depends on plasma effects. So it also depends on Faraday rotation intrinsic to the images themselves. So sometimes you can get much more scattered and disordered kind of spatial maps from these types of calculations. And so we need to really understand under what conditions you get which of these, but maybe something like this is a decent first guess that you could use for trying to construct crescent models or something. Okay. All right, so to summarize, I think crescent shapes coming from a combination of Doppler beaming and light bending are a good physically motivated idea for what black hole images might look like. And so based on that, what we've done is construct a geometric model that then is independent of many of the systematic uncertainties that are kind of in the way of directly inferring properties from any given theoretical model. Okay, we've shown that these models give a better description of current Sagittarius star data than other shapes that you might use, and you can also apply these. So if models are crescent shaped, it's very promising for detecting a black hole's shadow, and you can also use these to then simulate observations to see when you can learn various things from Event Horizon Telescope data. Okay, and one thing I want to highlight, so I just started at MPE, and we'll be building a small group there, and we have open positions this year, both PhD positions and a postdoc position. So there are a lot of exciting things to do. This is, we're obviously entering a very exciting era for Event Horizon Telescope science, and also the VLTI Gravity will be coming online soon as well. So please visit the website, encourage excellent candidates to apply, or apply yourself. Okay, thanks for your attention.
Thanks, Jason. We have 6 minutes, I believe, for questions. And I think Thomas is first.
Well, it's not a question. It's more like a comment. I think you can rule out all a certain class of crescent shapes already by knowing that the closure phase is within plus minus a few degrees, 10 degrees or so. I mean, some of the crescents will not produce zero closure phases. You looked only at the amplitudes in your slides there. So when you take into account also the closure phase, probably could make even stronger statements.
That may be true. I mean, it'll certainly constrain the parameter space. I don't, from what I've looked at so far, I don't think it rules out a lot of these models. I think often you expect closure phases near zero. So for instance, Kazunori Akiyama did this with M87 closure phases that actually this even these very crescent models on certain triangles still produce basically zero closure phase. So.
Okay, and my second comment is with regard to the electron distributions. I mean, the brightness temperature is very high, and doesn't that rule out already thermal electrons? I mean, we have 10 to the 10 Kelvin, almost.
No, so in Sagittarius Star, this thermal electrons do an excellent job of explaining this. So you basically, in the theoretical models, you have thermal electrons that are basically at the brightness temperature producing the emission that you see. Something that I'm working on now, I do think this is a problem for saying that M87's emission is polarized emission is from an accretion disk. There, I think you can show that because of these recent polarization measurements, that thermal electrons would produce too large of an intrinsic rotation measure beyond what's actually measured. So there, I think there's a problem, but not in Sagittarius
Star. Okay, question on the top.
Yes, Jason, as you know, when we look at our data, we often find quite a significant fall off of flux density from the zero spacing flux density to the first true VLBI baseline of a few hundred kilometers. Do you think that this is primarily due to a small fraction of non-thermal electrons? And would you predict, therefore, that this gap, this drop in flux density would be highly variable?
So this is something that we're looking at. I got briefly very excited about this, but I think it's on too small of scale. So the size of the image of the power law electrons is not really large enough to be completely unresolved by the short baseline. So we'll still look into that, but I'm less excited about it now. But I do think it's nice that, I mean, it's such a clear signature, and it's sort of independent of viewing orientation, too, that you can to find this halo of emission. So I think you can really put good constraints on how much flux can be in a component like that. Of course, there are different ways of distributing non-thermal electrons, so it's some statement about how they're distributed and what fraction they are, but still interesting nonetheless.
Thanks, Vincent. Any other questions? There's still a good amount of time.
Robert.
Given that presumably the inner radius of the shadow is achromatic, can you extend your crescent fitting to multi-frequency data taken at reasonably similar times? Does that help?
It's hard. So first of all, we'd have to have spatially resolved observations at 345 gigahertz. So for simulating future data, so Angelo has played around with this. I mean, the main issue is that the accretion flow is not completely optically thin at 230 gigahertz, and so you have to make some assumption of what happens to your crescent parameters at different frequencies, and that's not very easy to do. So, for instance, those different models that I showed that, you know, at 230, maybe we can say they're all sort of these crescents, they make very different predictions at 345 gigahertz, both for total flux and for spatial structure. So I've been trying to push for a while that if an EHT run could be done in conjunction with a 345 gigahertz measurement of total flux, that would actually be a huge independent constraint on the models right now. You mean between like 215 and 230 or something? I actually have not looked at that at all. That's an interesting question. Yeah, I don't.
Okay, we can take one more question. Andrew, you can come set up in the meantime. One more question. Shep, go ahead this time.
So, Jason, when you look at a face-on model, you wind up seeing a shadow, but it's not really the last photon orbit. It's more of a funnel.
Sorry, say that again?
When you look at a face-on image, you wind up seeing a shadow, but it's not really the last photon orbit. It's more of a funnel. So
you have both effects, right? So, I mean, especially when you often see the bright photon ring feature, And then you know that inside of that, if you can identify that, then you know that inside of that is still the shadow. I mean, it's true that you can have funnels too. So even in low frequency images, you could have gaps just because there's no gas there. But I guess this is maybe an advantage then for using a photon ring rather than just a shadow alone, is that then you kind of know what you're looking at.
Okay.
Fantastic, Jason. Thanks very much. Let's thank our speaker once again.